And interesting enough, his was on sticks and stones, I believe she said, and mine is talking about a rock. So they might go a little hand in hand. We might see some correlation between the two. I have titled this one, The Rock That Broke It All. This is going to be different than what I normally do when it comes to a lesson, because almost everything I'm going to be looking at and discussing with you this evening is going to come from one chapter in the Old Testament. The other morning, it was extremely cold, but I was sitting out across the parking lot from Sam's apartment in my car, waiting until the heater had warmed up a little bit and the defrost was going, and I had Radio Mom playing, and they had a preacher on there that was discussing with the DJ about, you know, people that say, you know, or argue about God's omnipresence and omniscience and all those, you know, the omnis. But he was referring to the omniscient ability for God to know everything. And he asked him, you know, is there a go-to verse or section in the Bible? And he's like, yeah. He goes, I go to Daniel 2. And I was like, Daniel 2? You know, and think about Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel and Meshach, Shadrach, Abednego. And I was like, and then he started making some connections, and it kind of intrigued me. So I started doing a study and putting some information together. Over the past probably 6-7 years, I've really gotten more into the archaeology that goes on in our world today that is continuing to dig up these old civilizations and proving the Old Testament. There are several characters and kings and people that are mentioned in the Old Testament that people just didn't believe existed until recent times, when they've unearthed these different coins and shards of clay and actual tablets of stone where their names are now mentioned. They're like, wow, the Bible is actually being proven here through archaeology. So that's been fascinating. So I'm going to share some historical aspects that go along with Daniel 2. So if you'd like to open your book with me, as I said, it's going to be a little different than what I normally do. I normally take a thought or an idea or a theme and just kind of go through that and build upon it using Old Testament and New Testament. This is going to be more of like my reading class. I talk to my readers constantly about not being race car readers. And I use that terminology because they will sit down and I'll say, okay, I've got these 3 pages I need you to read, and then we're going to discuss it. Vroom! They read it, and in 5 minutes, I'm done. Okay, so what was the theme? Oh. So if we just sit there and read it, if you're like me at least, and several of my students, your brain will think about anything and everything else, right? We call that our distracting voice in my class and at my school, and everything else will pop in there. So we're trying to teach our students to engage our thinking brain. So what I'm going to do with you tonight is hopefully engage your thinking brain, and then after we go through a couple verses, actually stop and discuss and just take a look at it and ask some just basic questions. I'm not sure I'll bring out any new information for you tonight, but hopefully just, you know, reaffirm that, you know, God's word is definite and it's true and it is confirmed throughout history, and he shows his power immensely in Daniel chapter 2. So we're going to start with the verse 1 of Daniel chapter 2. It says, now in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king gave orders to call in the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came in, they stood before the king. The king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we will declare the interpretation. The king replied to the Chaldeans, the command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. But if you declare to the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts, a reward, and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation. They answered a second time and said, let the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will declare the interpretation. So when we look at what's being asked of these individuals, he doesn't just want to know what the dream is about. He wants them to tell him his dream, right? We still have people today that will declare, if you tell me what you dreamt, I will tell you what it was about. We have psychologists and psychiatrists. I know when I took child psychiatry, one of our chapters was about dream interpretation, that if a kid tells you they dreamt about this, you could tell them it was about that. To me, that's a bunch of crazy nonsense, but, you know, there may be some foundation to it. But this goes beyond that, and the king realizes what these people have done for many years, right? He knows that there's tricks. He knows that there's routines that they're going to go through. If he tells them what his dream was about, they could say anything. Anything that seems logical, they can sit there and reason and say, oh, it must be this and it must be that. But he doesn't want that. He says, no, you're going to tell me what I dreamed first. And then you're going to tell me the interpretation. You know, still today, if you would go out there, I found three books easily by typing in dream interpretation books, and there was a couple hundred there. You can go to any bookstore and find them. You can go to websites, and you can pay a lot of money to go to a psychiatrist or psychologist, and they will try to tell you the same thing. But this goes beyond what King Nebuchadnezzar was demanding. When we start in verse 8, he says, the king replied, I know for certain that you are bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command from me is firm. But if you do not make the dream known to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you can declare it to me and its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or Chaldean. Moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there is no one else who could declare it to the king except gods, though whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. He tells them, I know what you're doing. I know what your plan is. If I tell you, you're going to get together, you're going to share your thoughts and ideas, and then you're going to present this grandiose explanation to me. Right? And if we think about oftentimes the consequences of going against a king, it was probably going to be something that he was going to be the greatest king that's going to live forever. And, you know, he's not going to have any of that. He truly wants to know what it's about. And we could see that he's not going to tolerate any of their nonsense. They explain to him, King, there's no other king that's ever asked anyone to do this. We do not have the ability. For once, they're being honest. They're right. They don't. King, there is no one on this earth that can possibly do what you're asking us to do. You want us to read your mind and tell you what it means? That's impossible. Well, that doesn't make the king happy. When we continue on in verse 12, it says, because of this, the king became indignant and very furious and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain. And they looked for Daniel and his friends to kill them. The fact that they say it's impossible to do, it's never been requested before, and there's not a single man on this earth that can do it, the king becomes very upset. Every wise man is going to be killed. And then we have suddenly Daniel and his friends appearing in this chapter. So if you turn back to chapter 1, a quick introduction, which as Bible scholars, I am sure you already know, but just so we know who we're talking about and where they come from. At the beginning of Daniel, we see how Daniel goes from being in the tribes and set up as a wise man for King Nebuchadnezzar. It begins in verse 3, says, then the king ordered Aspenaz, the chief of the officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had the ability for serving in the king's court. He ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. So we can see where the king is establishing his wise men that are going to be serving him during his reign, And then it says in verse 6, now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them, which we know more when it comes to the other three other than Daniel. It says, and to Daniel he assigned the name Belshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. And I can remember from a very young boy singing that song, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? Went to Judah a long time ago. So those names we're familiar with. And these are the individuals that are now the wise men in chapter 2 that are going to be hunted down. Now, I find it interesting that the wise men were called before King Nebuchadnezzar and to give these answers, but yet not all the wise men were there. Because when it comes time to fulfill the king's command, they have to go out and find Daniel and his friends. Daniel does not know what's going on, and we can see in verse 14 he begins to question what has happened. It says, Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He said to Arioch, the king's commander, for what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? Then Arioch informed Daniel about the matter. So Daniel went in, and he requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. So as we're going along, we can see that Daniel begins to explain to his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, what's taking place. It says, Daniel went to his house and informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, about the matter, so that they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Now, when we look at the wording that they use, and we look at the original translation is request, and it means to beseech, right? To beg. So it's one of those, if you think about, you really feel like something needs to happen. I gave the example this morning at Delphi this past week. I was giving tests on Friday. I had a young man that was having a really rough day anyway. Just was not able to focus. Time was running out. They had a couple of tests they had to do on their own and get them submitted. And he just wasn't, you know, with me. And I said, okay, you got to put your reading stuff away. It's time for science. He slammed his book down on the desk. You've got to give me more time. That doesn't go over real well in Mr. Barker's class. Yeah. This could have been one of those situations where Daniel said, okay, God, I'm getting ready to die. I need you to do this for me. And that is not what the translation tells us at all. He went in humbly to beseech God's help. They made a request. I was talking to my student. I said, okay, so what's going on? You know, he's like, well, my puppy, it's sick. It hasn't gotten out of my bed for 3 days. My mom says it's not going to live. It's been alive since I was a baby. And I'm like, so your puppy? I found out the dog was 14 years old, and it was, by the time he got home, it had passed. But, you know, so he was having a hard day. And I said, you know, if you let me know what's going on, you talk to me calmly, I'll listen to you, and we'll work with you. That's what Daniel does here. He doesn't demand God anything. He goes in humbly to God and looks to him in prayer. And he says, this is what I need. Right? And that's the kind of God that we have. Now, it's not demanding of God. They understand that God has the power to give them the answer. And in the same way, God has the power to not be involved. They don't demand it. They just simply give it to God and say, this is what we need. Many times that we go into God to prayer, we make a request, and sometimes that answer is no. And that's hard for us because we feel like we really know what is best for us. But God knows what's best for us truly. And sometimes that answer is no. That was not the case here. They went in, they asked, and we could see in verse 19, it says, then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. Now, this is where I want you to think. Put yourself in Daniel's position, right? You were just told a couple hours ago, your life is going to end. You're going to be torn apart, and your house is going to be destroyed and be rubbish, and so are your friends and all the other wise men that you know. The king is not happy. You find out the answer. I'm thinking as a person, my first thing is going to be is to jump out of bed and run down the hall to the king's room and pound on the door and say, I've got the answer, I've got the answer. But that is not what Daniel does, right? Daniel doesn't think of himself first. Daniel doesn't act first to defend himself. The first thing he does is he gives God the glory. I could tell you there are times where I've been down in life and I've prayed and God has answered my prayer and it's taken me a while to remember to thank God for answering my prayer. The first thing that we should do is to thank God for answering our prayers. Acknowledge what he has done for us. You know, Daniel sets a great example for us in that. He pops out of bed and he praises God and he gives him thanks. He says, Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel said, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. He acknowledges first and foremost, what God has done. But then he continues. He said, it is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. Even now you have made known to me what we requested of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter. You have answered our prayers. Right? And what would be the second thing that you would do? Then go and pound on this door. Hey, I've got the answer. He doesn't do that either. The second thing that he does in verse 24 says, therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows. Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king. Think about those two actions in which he had done. He gave God the glory, and then he took care of his neighbors. Does that sound familiar? How many times have we read those in the Old Testament and in the New Testament that there are two great commandments? Love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and everything that you possibly have, and then love your neighbor as yourself. And Daniel sets that example for us without even realizing it, before those commandments are even really given and repeated, definitely before they are told to us again in the New Testament, that yes, those are the greatest commandments, and everything that God wants us to do rests upon those. But Daniel set that example for us thousands of years ago. Then it says they went. Now they get to pound on the king's door. Then Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows. I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king. The king said to Daniel, whose name was Belshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? What are you going to say? Yeah, I can do it. Right? Not what Daniel says. Daniel says, as for the mystery about which the king has required, neither wise men, conjurer, magician, nor diviners are able to declare it to the king. No, king, I can't do it. Right? God's given him the interpretation, and God's given him the dream. So he has the answer. But the king's question was not necessarily what he was expecting an answer for. Can you do it? And Daniel wants to say right then and there, no, I can't. But there is somebody that can. He says in verse 26, the king, are you able to make known? Oh, sorry. I already touched on that. Verse 28, however, there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the later days. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while on your bed. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turn to what would take place in the future. And he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. Daniel, can you tell me? I cannot. But the God in heaven sure can. There is somebody that you do not recognize, somebody that you do not know, that I know, that is going to tell you your answers. He gives God the glory. He takes care of his friends. And then he does not want any recognition whatsoever. He gives God all the recognition in front of the king. In verse 30, then it continues, says, "But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me more than in any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind." It's not me, king. I cannot do it. I do not have the ability, but the God in heaven is willing to let you know. It says, "You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. Now we will tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom and power, the strength and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the fields, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. After you, there will rise another kingdom inferior to you, then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. Then there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron. Inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things, so like iron that breaks its pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron. Inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay, as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong, and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere one to another, even as iron does not combine with pottery." He begins by telling him and explaining to him that as Babylon and the king of Babylon, that God has allowed you to be king. God has given you the power to be king, and you are that head of gold. It's got to make you feel good, right? I'm sure that that might have been part of the things that the other magicians would have said if they had known what the dream was. But imagine if you're Nebuchadnezzar. He begins to tell you what you dreamt. Never been done before, right? I can't tell any of you what you've dreamt. And if you wanted me to come up with something, I surely wouldn't have come up with this. Right? This is out in left field. This is not something I can ever imagine anyone would just ever think of. So if he's all of a sudden telling you everything that you saw and what took place, you're going to listen to that interpretation, I would think. Right? And if he tells you God has allowed you, the God in heaven who has revealed this secret dream to me, and he's allowed you to be the king, I'm thinking you would pay attention. Right? Now we know Nebuchadnezzar often reacted instead of thinking and acting, right? He got angry, so he threw the three men into the burning furnace and looked down, and they were protected, right? There was four in there. He let them out. Got angry with Daniel and declared a decree. Anyone that does not bow down, they're going to throw them into the lion's den. And he really cared about Daniel, but he did it anyway. And he mourned, and he didn't sleep. And the next morning, he had said, "Did your God save you?" So he understands who this God is. This is his first encounter with this God, our God, the God of heaven. And this is the first time he's realizing that he's been put into power by this mighty being. Then he says, after you, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you. So when we look at history, and some of you are more history buffs, I've recently begun to enjoy history and never liked it in school, and I definitely do not enjoy teaching it. But when we start looking and we start looking at dates, and we can take our dates all the way back into the BC eras with recorded history, and especially through archaeology and things that have been proven through these archaeological digs, it talks about in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, how the his entire community had become this great, powerful group. And basically, they were just taking in all of these other citizens and communities. It talked about the tribe of Judah and how they took in the children of Israel, and they were in power over them. Kind of like the whole idea of slaves in the when they were slaves in Egypt, right? And they had to bow down, and they had to follow what Nebuchadnezzar said. And then every king after him in the Babylonian era. But as we're reading, then we start seeing that there is another group that begins to rise. But it's two individual powers. So we had the Medes and we have the Persians. And they were often enemies. And then they decided in history to combine together to make one. And when this happened, you ended up with the Medo-Persian Empire. Now look at the idea of the upper body being silver, still mighty and powerful. And the idea that there are two arms. Two separate groups that are in control. You had two separate kings at that time also. And they didn't always agree. They had internal conflicts. But when these two dominant powers came together, they defeated Babylon. They wiped out all the other communities in that area. They just took over the land and they began to spread out. They were a dominant force to deal with. And here we have Daniel, through the power of God, interpreting that these individuals are going to come in and destroy you. Now, this is where the preacher was talking the other morning on Radio Mom. He's like, you know, anyone could have said, hey, I know the rumors about this Persian Empire, and I know the rumors about the Mede Empire, and I'm going to predict that they're going to come together and they're going to wipe us out. That could have been predicted, right? They could have said, ah, yeah, we know there's going to be issues, there's going to be problems. Okay. So he said that's not the most impressive part. But when I began to continue on in history and how they started to take over that whole Middle Eastern area that we see today, and we follow their history, then in 331, we have a group that didn't even exist at this time. So in 331, Alexander the Great came in and he defeated the Medes and the Persians, the Meso-Persian dominance. So in 336 BC, Alexander the Great is king of Greece. Sometimes you're going to read that it's referred to as the Mesopotamians. But from 332 and 331, they went into battle and they completely dominated the Medes and the Persians. So the Medo-Persian Empire ends at that time. Now, this was a no-name group. So if you know anything about the Greeks and how they started, they were just these little farming communities with a central group of about 1,000 people. And then they began to study arts and sciences, and they began to grow in knowledge, and they began to bring people in. And this is where the people became the rulers, and they had councils that oversaw them. This group did not exist in the time of Nebuchadnezzar. How could they possibly have predicted that this group was going to come along and destroy the Medo-Persians? Well, as Daniel had said, there's no man, there's no magician, there's no magical being out there that could. But God in heaven absolutely can. They continued on wiping out what part of what we call Europe now, all the way down into Egypt. If you know about the history of Egypt, I believe somebody had said the other day, might have been Jim in our class, leaving your mark, or maybe it was last Lord's Day in one of our sermons, but talked about Alexander the Great, how he had several cities that he named after himself. And Alexandria is still a huge city in Egypt today that he had founded and was named after him. So it was a very dominant group, but that wasn't enough, right? He predicted after them, there's going to be another group that comes along, right? This group started out as a little itty-bitty farming community with one crazy wackadoodle man who decided, hey, we're going to start just taking over all the other lands around us. And they went from a little farming community to a town, and then they became this military dominance that just decided we're going to take over the world. If we look at history, and we can study history, and this is a group that's mentioned from the Old Testament throughout the New Testament, right? Rome was a major powerhouse of the world, right? They came along, they defeated the Greeks rather easily, and then they established themselves, and they began to spread out all that over that Middle Eastern part of the world, into Europe, into Africa, Israel, everywhere. Rome became dominant, but the idea of the two legs and the iron and the clay really indicates on how Rome had decided. So Rome, if you look at the history of them, they studied why all these great powers had fallen. And it was because they demanded that the people worship, follow, practice, adopt their cultures, and become like them. The Babylonians did it. The Medes and the Persians did it. The Greeks did it. They expected everyone to follow their practices. So Rome went in and they said, well, we're going to be the power. And as long as they pay taxes to us, they could do whatever they want. Great idea. It lasted for a few hundred years and it was successful. But when Daniel is talking about God says that the clay and the iron won't mix, that's exactly what had happened. They ended up with two councils that did the ruling in Rome. They had the pure Romans, and then they had what was referred to as the mixed Romans. They were the ones that mixed with the barbaric groupings. So the women took husbands took women, and they began to have idolatry. And right, Rome was all about Roman mythology. Right, we have the gods in Olympus, and that's who answers all. And then this other group was worshiping other idols, but they didn't care. They weren't about, hey, you can't do that. They're like, ah, we'll all just get along. Right? Think about denominationalism. Let's all just get along. There's no right or wrong. That's a scary world. It did last for a couple of hundred years, right? But it didn't last forever. One of the interesting aspects that I had never caught until I started doing some history was how Daniel focused in on the toes, right? We have 10 toes, most of us, right? Some people don't. Some people do. Some people have more. Yeah. Well, when you look at the history of Rome, as they began to have all of these internal problems, they established in their councils to divide up into, guess how many groups? 10 groups. And that was the true fall and destruction of Rome. They basically just dissipated and went away. But I didn't even know that. Because I've read that before. Well, you notice the toes, and I'm like, what? It's toes. I don't, you know. But when you start looking, who could have predicted that to happen? No man could, right? Daniel says, I can't do it, but the God in heaven can. As we look at that, we can see how God is truly involved in everything. But the dream is not finished, right? He says, in the days of those kings, the kings of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put on the end to all of these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. Inasmuch as you saw that this stone was created not by hands, right? One true, great, and holy God. And he created a stone. A stone that would defeat every other nation throughout history. So when we start looking at Isaiah 28:16-17, it says, therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a costly cornerstone for the foundation firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed. I will make justice the measuring line and the righteousness the level. Then hail will sweep away the refuge of lies and the waters will overflow the secret places. Isaiah begins to prophesy that there will be a change. Right? He tells the children of Israel, this is what you have done. This is the Mosaic law. These are the commandments and these are the offerings that you must make. But there's a change coming. They knew it. They were prepared for it. They were seeking it. David writes in Psalms 118, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Prophesied over and over and over again, the stone was going to happen. Daniel talked about the same stone. It's going to go and wipe out everything that ever existed. And it's one that is eternal. It can't be destroyed. It will not be bothered. And then Jesus says in Matthew, he says, did you never read in the scriptures the stone which the builders rejected? This became the chief cornerstone. This came about from the Lord, and it is a marvelous in our eyes. Therefore, I say unto you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people, producing the fruit of it. And he who fails, who falls on the stone, will be broken to pieces, but on whomever it falls, it will scatter him like dust. They didn't want to listen to Jesus, did they? That's not who their Messiah is. It can't be. This can't be our king that's going to come down and lead us to glory. Well, they were not listening to what the scriptures were actually saying. They wanted a physical realm. And God even said in this own dream here, back to Nebuchadnezzar, and then throughout all, it's not a physical world. It's not a physical kingdom. It is not a I'm holier or richer than thou. It is an eternal one. And it's a spiritual one. Jesus says that the cornerstone is here, and yet they don't like its appearance. It says, in those days of heaven, God will set up that kingdom, and it will never be destroyed. So now we look at, once again, history. Rome. What was the original fall that began to break Rome up? We know the Caesars had great power, right? They were letting anybody worship the way they wanted to. And those Jews over there, they were nice, calm individuals for many years. And they did what they were supposed to. And they paid their taxes. And then some guy came and messed it all up. I had a revolt going on in the Jewish community. The children of Israel were complaining. They were coming to Caesar and all the other rulers in the area, and they were complaining about this Messiah, this Christ, this Savior that was prophesied about in their book of the law. They were not happy. That's not who they wanted. The fall of Rome began when they began to go against Christianity and they tried to persecute Christians. We can even see where Saul, before he became Paul, persecuted the Christians because they didn't want this stone. This was not who their Messiah was. But God had prophesied, yeah, it is. And he will destroy all of these kingdoms, including Rome. In 1 Peter, Peter writes, this precious value then is for you who believe, but for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the very cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. For they stumble because they are disobedient to the word, and to this doom they were also appointed. The children of Israel did not want, the scribes and Pharisees did not want him. This could not be him. Did they let the people decide? Did they bring it to the courts during the daytime and let the people hear the trial? No, they went against their own laws and they put him on trial at night in secret. And then who did they present him to? Not the people. They took him to the different Roman leaders. Rome didn't care. This wasn't their God. This wasn't their Bible. They didn't believe. They just wanted the nonsense to stop. And we can see Pontius Pilate washing his hands. This isn't my doing. This is your will. Peter continues in verse 9. It says, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. To whom is he talking? Not the Jews. He said, you are a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of the darkness into his marvelous light. These are the individuals that would be considered Gentiles or unfaithful Jews. They were not accepted in God's original law because they could not trace their lineage back to Abraham. But now they have become that kingdom. For you once were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. That stone has come and destroyed all other rulers and nations in this world. And it was established. And it begins in verse 35, and the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them was found. But that stone that struck the statue became a great mountain, and it filled the whole earth. Christ struck every other ruler and knocked it away. The greatest ruler that he destroyed was Satan. He ruled death. He ruled the earth until Jesus conquered him by coming back to life through the power of his Father. He defeated him, and he established a kingdom that can never be rocked, can never be destroyed, can never be taken away, can never be minimized. In Matthew 4:17, it says, "From that time Jesus began to preach and say, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand.'" It's here, and you have a chance to be part of it. He was telling them that 2,000 years ago. It's here. You've been looking for it. The prophets told you about it. Right? All of you people that you look up to and admire in the Old Testament, they told you I was coming. And it's here, and it's been established. In Hebrews 12:28, it says, "Therefore, since we receive a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us show gratitude by which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe." Our kingdom cannot be shaken, and that mountain fills the entire earth. So we're talking about a dream that happened 606 B.C., all right, so I just want you to think, what this preacher was trying to get us to understand is we can look at history and we can look at the current world and we can make some predictions. So let's look at what we're going to be talking about as a country this week, right? The first year on this country was not so good for us, right? We came over as pilgrims and almost starved to death. Luckily, the Native Americans helped us survive. We had a little bitty amount of land. Right? We were still English citizens. So this happened in 1607. Could the pilgrims have predicted that their ancestors would become traitors? That they would declare their own independence? That not only would they have signed and gone away from England, but they would also multiply their land by threefold at least? Could that have been predicted that that's what our country would look like in just 169 years? Or how about from that point? Could we have known that 288 years later we would have had 50 states, right? I was reading an article once talking about the 48th state. When it was established, that was it because we were out of land. And then what'd we do? We bought some more. Hey, Russia, why don't you let us have Alaska, right? Hey, Japan, let us have Hawaii. We have more. And our country has not just become large in area, but look at where we are today. We're on our 45th president. Could the pilgrims have known about that? Our farms are successful. You're talking about individuals who almost all died out because they had no way of knowing how to grow food in this country. We have people that don't look like they're from England, right? We're not all white, blonde, Caucasians. Right? Our Americans are a mixture of people. Could they have known that in that amount of time, so we're talking about 243 years from the time that we became a country, right? People think about how long ago that was. That's a short amount of time. It's a total of 412 years. And think about what Daniel explained, what God allowed him to see. What Nebuchadnezzar, we're talking about 606 BC. And in that time frame, everything that took place, right? God knew in 606 years before Christ that Christ was going to come and he was going to be established. He was the rock and he was going to wipe out every other civilization. And he was going to establish a kingdom that would last forever. He prophesied that in this little itty bitty area where Nebuchadnezzar was, that rock would grow into a mountain that would spread throughout the entire world. And 639 years before Christ died on the cross, he prophesied that a new way was coming, and it would establish a kingdom not of the physical realm, but one of spiritual that would never be shaken and could never be destroyed. 2,225 years ago, he prophesied that you and I would be a part of that kingdom. Now, please understand that back then, they didn't even know that this side of the world even existed, right? Most of them didn't even know there was an ocean, let alone more of the land that we call Europe. But yet God knew that there would be a kingdom established that would cover the entire world, and that you and I would have a chance to be in it. That it would cross that great ocean and be established today. And we continue to preach it and to teach it. God prophesied that about us, knowing that if we desire to accept him, to acknowledge him, as Daniel did, to love him with all of our heart, soul, and mind, and to love others as we do ourselves, to seek him first, his kingdom, and his righteousness, to be forgiven of our sins and baptized so that we can be added to that kingdom that was talked about 2,225 years ago. Who could have ever known? Daniel says, not me, not your magicians, but the God in heaven knows. And he told them then, and he continued to tell them throughout all of history. And then it was established. And the amazing thing was, is that those last two countries, the Greeks and the Romans, did not even exist as individuals on this earth. And yet God said, hey, they're coming. But so is my son. And that stone will destroy everything else. And that will establish a kingdom that can never be taken away. That's a mighty God. Amen. It's amazing. And that's more knowledge than I had ever gotten in all my race car reading of Daniel chapter 2. And all the times that I've read it before, I find it interesting. I thought, oh, yeah, it's a cool, you know, the statue's there. But to think about all that he truly said, underlined, it's an amazing God that we have. That is our lesson this evening. And I'm sorry I did go longer than I had anticipated. But hopefully it was one that just helps you reassure your faith and understand just how mighty and loving our God is to establish it that long ago for a place that you could call home. So that he can see you in the end and he, when his son presents his kingdom to him. If you have anything that needs to be brought before the congregation this evening, won't you come forward as we stand and sing?